Chapter 40. Oromondo. The years passed quickly for Somroth. His sixth flame, which had been awarded for his successful leadership during an incursion force into Alpatar to strip the country clean of foodstuffs, faded into his skin. A newly tattooed seventh flame now sat on his brow in recognition of his able work forging new protectors over these last years. He had attained the rank of firemaker, but he used the common term, general. He built up a disciplined force. Better food would have allowed him to improve the men's physical strength, but the Alpatar spoils were not limitless. Amongst the men, he had a reputation as businesslike and aloof, insistent on obedience. His army of 20,000 currently massed on a high plateau situated outside of Tucasta. Magi too had lost all her hair except for a few white strands she allowed to straggle around her bald head. Her pupils glowed red, while the whites now looked egg yellow. She wore a loose gown of white, and over it a thick tabard with flames etched in rubies.
"Protect us!"
she hailed the troops. Somroth, standing close to her, could have sworn she whispered, yet by magic craft her voice carried to the multitude of waiting soldiers.
"You are the pride of Oromondo. You represent the hope of Oromondo. On you rests the safety of the land. The Mellies are not the simple goat herds that awaited you to the south in Alpatar. They are brave fighters, prepared for our invasion. You should anticipate stiff resistance. But no matter how much they struggle against our righteousness, you must prevail today. Years of training have honed you into the best warriors of Enirmon. And you know that the land needs and expects this victory. We Magi demand this victory."
A loud chorus of
"Duty, strength, the eight, the power of the eight, long will their flames burn and conquer,"
interrupted her speech. She held up her hands to quiet the crowd.
"Save your breath, protectors. We know how loyal you are. We praise you among the men of the land, second dearest to our hearts, only after our sacred priests. Our strength is your strength. Your strength is ours. Posar's flames course through you. Smite our enemies on our behalf. Let Meli blood water their prairies. Should you fall, the flames of Oromondo will sing your names into the ever after."
She let her ropey arms drop, and a deep hush pervaded the field. A moment later, the sound of thousands of soldiers tapping their breastplates with their dagger pommels arose. She stepped down from the hastily constructed stage, Somroth following behind. Magi too wheeled to grab Somroth's forearm.
"We will help you in the pass, but we will not journey into heathen countries leaving the land. Win us this victory, General, or your life will be forfeit. We will see you burned alive."
"Divinity, I would expect no less,"
he replied. His arm felt scorched from where she touched it, but he would not allow himself to look at the burn. Somroth surveyed his troops. He had no complex battle plan to employ here. One pass only. The mouth of the mountains stretched wide enough for his army. It led through the high peaks and onto the steppes of Meladrin.
Their soldiers knew his were coming. He knew theirs waited. This day would hinge on force and will. Magi too spoke truly. The Meles fought well. Even though their style differed completely from that adopted in Orimondo, they had proven this in the War of the Priests. Meles wore no armour, only thick leathers, relying instead upon their fleetness of foot. They favoured archery, using recurved bows made out of lacquered wood rather than the sword or pike, and they shot these bows unerringly even when running or seated atop their sparse herd of small and shaggy horses. But these arrows, which did not fly with as much force as those shot from longbows, should bounce off the protector's steel armour. While on patrol on the steep borders, protectors were only helm and breastplate to lighten their load for their arduous climbs. But for this battle, they would add shoulder greaves and thigh protectors. Somroth had no bowmen. 2 generations ago, when by some witch's curse the soldiers' eyesight would no longer allow them to hit their targets, all archery units had been disbanded. The general planned to bull through the Meli defence of the pass with 5,000 men, then bring the rest of his regiment, 15,000 troops and supply wagons, along tomorrow after clearing the way. All reports agreed. Meladrim was a sparsely populated country. Somroth estimated that he'd be facing 1,000 defenders at the most. Though his enemy would hold the high ground, Somroth counted on the protectors' armour, their numbers, and their discipline to win the day. Not to mention Magi II's powers. Somroth looked about, checking that the flag bearers, their banner a black mountain profile spitting out 8 flames, trumpeters and his underlings, stood at readiness. He did not want to tarry under the sun. Even on this early spring day, this much armour felt stifling. The mouth of the mountain stretched about 1 league in length, and its span was broad enough for 20 cavalrymen to ride abreast. His cavalry rode aurochs, nasty oxen-like beasts. Though they moved ponderously and their bony spines made riding uncomfortable, aurochs had proven more resistant to the plagues than horses. Among their other deficits, however, these creatures could not be trained in battle tactics. They served only as crude conveyances. Somroth gave the signal to move forward, and the horns commenced their signals. His army set off with a roar and the tramp of thousands of feet. Magi II carried in a palanquin, took a position near the front. Halfway through the mouth lay the border marker where one left the land and passed into territory held by unbelievers. As a palanquin neared the boundary, Magi II stepped out of her conveyance. She held up both arms and pointed her index fingers. Fire broke out on the ridgelines, consuming all the trees, brush and low growth. The flames raced in straight lines bordering the pass, pushing the Meli archers lying in wait back from their positions, obscuring their sight and compromising their air. Even with this barrier, when Somroth's first battalion, commanded by an eager fifth flamer, reached the boundary line, enemies perched on high braved the flames and smoke to push down boulders about the size of goats. These bounced against the cliff faces and hit the ground with formidable crashes. These projectiles killed, injured or disrupted whole squads of men and aurochs. "Keep moving," Somroth ordered, knowing that the Meli's supply of boulders had to be limited. Sure enough, rocks followed boulders. Unless these fell directly on a soldier's head, these killed fewer. But they still maddened the aurochs into running amok. Many of Somroth's foot soldiers were killed or injured by their own mounts rather than the enemy. The general, who entered in the middle of the column, looked behind him. The last of his troops had moved from the assembly point to enter the mouth of the mountains. Magi II's palanquin, however, had done an about-face and returned to the land. All at once, a wall of flame as tall as the octagon rose behind them, cutting off any retreat. Magi II had used her power to state forward or burn.
Somroth took out his whip, laying it into Aurochs and men alike.
Forward! Don't lag, move forward! Quicker! Go, go, go!
His officers copied his actions, whipping buttocks and backs of legs.
Forward! They yelled. Forward lies safety! Tarry and you die!
After the Mellies had used up all the rocks they'd fetched to the top of the cliff, they turned to their arrows. Because the brush fires obscured their vision, instead of aiming, the enemy let their arrows sail in massed flights, cutting the air with a whirring noise. When an arrow hit armour, it bounced off with a loud clang, but often enough the barbs bit flesh, and the pass echoed with the men's cries and curses. A fourth flamer, using his whip liberally, pushed back through the press to report to Somroth,
"Sir, they've dug a ditch at the opening. It's too wide to cross. Archers on high and standing on the opposite side are cutting us down."
Somroth had expected some sort of barrier. The Mellies would want to slow them down to reap more casualties.
"Deploy the plates to cover the frontline companies. Fill in the ditch with the casualties. We must keep moving forward."
Although Oros normally carried no shields because they were too heavy and cumbersome for patrolling mountain trails, Somroth had ordered metalsmiths to forge gigantic shield-like plates for protection against melee arrows. These he had placed in Aurok's cart just behind the vanguard. Holding these plates both in front of them and overhead as protection, his soldiers dragged dead men and animals into the shallow trench. If Melly managed to shoot a protector during this dangerous duty, well, his body contributed more fill. Finally, his front battalion strode over this unstable, yielding obstacle onto the high steps of Melodrin. Aurochs and carts that followed the 1st Brigade bogged down among the corpses until a clever 3rd Flamer had the idea of laying the metal plates down on top to make a more solid surface. If any of the men in the ditch still had a spark of life in them, they were smothered under the crushing weight. When Somroth's front line succeeded in pushing past this trap, the standing archers turned and ran. But behind them appeared a troop of Melly cavalry, directly massed in front of the opening of the pass. Like waving a flag in front of a bull, the sight of the enemy on flat ground, nasty bows notched to shoot their cursed arrows right in front of them, caused his vanguard officers to charge pell-mell. The Melly cavalry immediately galloped off.
"A ruse!"
Somroth shouted to junior officers surrounding him. Somroth mentally complimented the Melly battle commander, whomever he was, for enticing his men forward without a backward glance. As soon became apparent, the enemy had moved the main force of their archers from the top of the pass to the cover along the slopes of the foothills on either side of the mouth's opening. These archers began picking off protectors from behind. A bare arm here, a naked leg there, a neck or an Auroch's haunch.
"We must flank them,"
Somroth yelled, dispatching battalions to climb above the hidden archers. Slowly, inexorably, scrambling sideways on the foothill's incline, his troops flushed the Melly bowmen down onto the plain. Now his troops could engage their foes directly. Somroth himself rode out of the mouth. He drew his greatsword and kicked his stinking Aurochs into running over a fleeing Melly. Hungry for more, he soared on the reins until the cursed animal obeyed and turned right, where he could slash off the arm of another enemy trying to escape. Controlling his own battle lust, Somroth rode to the top of a tiny hillock to survey the terrain. He motioned for his aide to bring him water, and he took off his red plumed helmet for a moment to wipe the sweat off his head.
"The tide has turned."
Though some Mellies halted to shoot, and the damned enemy cavalry wreaked havoc in small rushes, his men outnumbered their foes, and the Mellies were running out of their barbarous arrows. Some protectors even began singing their battle hymn, "Cleansing Flames," as they brought down the unfaithful. Somroth roared with pride for his men's discipline and bravery.
"Yes! Make them pay!"
Within moments, the battle became a rout. When the enemy broke, hundreds of Melis swiftly scattered in every direction.
"Don't let them get away!"
Somroth shouted, his trumpeters and signalmen relaying this order to his officers.
"No mercy! No quarter!"
When his men could catch up with their fleeing foes, they hacked them down with pikes, halberds and swords. Somroth watched as three pikemen surrounding one enemy played a game by prodding him this way and that, each soldier keeping his weapon from making a killing thrust. Then the tricky Melly bastard feinted left and quickly rolled on the ground to the right, breaking out of the circle of spears. He might have escaped, too, but for a fourth flamer watching the sport who thrust his sword into the devil's gut. By the time the sun went down, bodies, Oro and Melly, covered the treeless step. Many of his men had injuries. Everyone swayed with exhaustion. Hunger and thirst assailed them. They had carried almost no provisions into battle so as not to be weighted down. They combed the bodies of their enemies, scavenging a few water bags and a sparse quantity of some kind of meat jerky. Somroth dismounted to examine a few of the corpses. He noticed that Melly men wore their hair cut neatly just below their ears on the sides and shaved close above the back of the neck to reveal the point of their skulls. But some of the smaller bodies had long plaits with strands of dark plum intermixed with their light brown. He turned a few of these over with his boots, surprised to discover that they were women.
"If their population is so low, they send their women into battle. We have little more to fear from them."
The Melly didn't herd or farm. Mostly they lived by hunting small wild game, and they roamed the Meladrin steppes, stopping only at temporary villages. Somroth knew, but had not told his men, they would find nothing in the way of supplies here. Even the first sizable river stretched a half-day's march away. This country was merely a desert to cross. After the desert, a slick 3-league causeway of boulders traversed the sea. On the other side of the causeway, however, stood the rich and densely populated free states, hubs of commerce with vast warehouses of grain and ships that could fetch stores home to the land. Somroth moved his forces away from the carrion and, after posting lookouts, let the protectors drop to the ground to sleep. In the middle of the night, a volley of arrows came arching into the camp from the featureless black, but when his men rushed that direction, the scum had faded away. He posted more guards.
"I will personally gut any man who sleeps on guard duty," he warned.
No sooner had his army gone back to sleep than another assault came in from another direction. By the third time, his forces did not even rush out. They just let the arrows reap their harvest.
"If Posar chose not to protect you, you might as well die while you slept."
At first light, Somroth's officers reported on casualties.
"General, 1,211 men are dead. As you see, we have started the pyres. 1,407 are wounded. We lost more than 300 Orocs."
"Of the wounded, how many will live with all limbs after moderate patching up?"
his officers conferred.
"About half. These took an arrow in the calf, a concussion, a smashed elbow."
"I don't care to hear the details. Send those back through the mouth to Tucaster. They can still be useful to the land."
"And the more seriously injured, sir?"
"Put them down. We have no resources to spare."
Somroth justified this to himself as a mercy. They were putting the brave souls out of their anguish and sending them to Posar. But in truth, he didn't agonize about this decision. He just followed customary practice.
If the priests who had accompanied his forces wished to say prayers, that was up to them.
Moreover, like his men, Somroth's powerful thirst crowded out almost every thought.
After reorganizing brigades, they set out for the river. In 3 leagues, they saw the glitter ahead of them. The Aurochs stampeded to get to water, and Somroth's men showed even less discipline.
While they drank water of surpassing sweetness, however, Melly archers picked off soldiers on one flank. While they forded the river, arrows flew from another unexpected direction. These random sneak attacks maddened his men. When a company did capture a group of 3 Mellies, 2 of them female, they flayed them alive. Somroth hoped that their screams would scare off other attackers. Perhaps their opponents kept a warier distance, but the harrying did not cease.
Soon enough, his main force of 15,000 men, with supply wagons pulled by Aurochs, caught up with Somroth. Umrat, the 6th flamer in command, had encountered little resistance as his troops crossed the blood-soaked fields. Showing initiative and common sense, Umrat had left behind butchering crews to carve up the dead Aurochs. After hours of stewing, the meat, while full of gristle, would be almost edible. Softer Aurochs' tongue would be served to officers. After 2 days' march, they came to a small village of thatched buildings. The place sat completely deserted. His soldiers tore down the huts, but found not a single grain of foodstuffs nor a single useful implement. Since his troops had looked forward to pillaging, they were furious, and they set the shelters alight. The fire moved into the surrounding grasslands, and a swell of small game rushed away from the flames. Subsequently, to supplement the supplies they had ferried from the land and the Aurochs' meat, they learned to set up a line of soldiers and set a field alight. When the pheasants, rabbits, and other game tried to escape, the pikemen bashed their heads in. In this way, they were able to get enough food to continue their march northward, ever northward, day after day. When the army reached the correct latitude, Somroth sent one of his more reliable officers, 6th Flamer Chumel, with several companies of protectors to take and hold the harbour of Drintulia. That was where he intended to ship back foodstuffs. Somroth kept up his stern demeanour, but inside he nurtured high hopes. He would go down in Oromondo history as the general who conquered all the northern countries, laying them prostrate at the Magi's feet.
Zia would never go hungry again. His people would never go hungry again.
And the unfaithful would serve the faithful, as Posar decreed.